I remember coming in here, but I didn't think it looked like this. Did you used to be right here? No, it looked different.
We might have worked in a smaller...
Yeah, because it looked real different when we came
to... The interior. This is classier, though.
It's very classy.
Matt, the old studio that we used to work in, it was a smoking room now. They're not allowed to smoke on the floor except in that one room. And unfortunately, it's a room where we often bring guests. And and there are ashtrays in there. Actually, smokers don't even bother with ashtrays. You know, they just stamp them out on the floor.
So. Yeah.
Do you ever smoke?
I used to smoke. And then I wanted to get married again. And I married a man that is really allergic to it. And he didn't make that like a condition. But it became very clear to me that I probably should quit, so I quit.
Gene, you grew up in the tobacco states, too.
Yeah, right.
You grew up in Grundy.
Oh, are we doing this? Are we doing it now? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Yes, I did. In Southwest Virginia.
What was Grundy like?
It is completely surrounded by mountains, and it's just a very small town. And it was really in the years when I was growing up there, it seemed real cut off from everything, which gave me a kind of privileged upbringing, I think, in a way. I didn't think of it as that when I was growing up, but it's very special.
How so was that a privileged upbringing?
Just because I think there are very few places in the country where somebody can grow up and have a sense of an intact culture, a sense of an accent, a kind of spoken language, a sort of an oral history, and all that kind of stuff that I really did get. And I think I'm about the last generation that's going to be able to get that kind of thing, which is why I go around taping there now.
Taping?
Taping my relatives. When I first started this, my Aunt Kate was 80, and I thought I got to tape her. I got to get all these stories. And as it turned out, there's not so much of a rush. She's 102 now, and she's still going. So, but, I mean, it's just this sense of a geographically intact section of the country for so long with its own music, its own everything.
Well, that's
lucky.
Yeah, that's interesting you say that. Are you familiar with Alan Gerganis? You know him?
Yeah, I know him. Well, yeah, he lives in Chapel Hill.
Yeah, he said very much the same thing that you said. He grew up in a small town, I believe in Virginia. I'm not sure. I think Virginia.
I think he's from Rocky Mount, North Carolina.
Well, maybe it's North Carolina.
Yeah.
I can't remember now. But we were talking, and he raised the same point that he grew up in a small town where everybody knew each other. So you were privy to a lot of stories, a lot more than you would be in a big impersonal city such as New York or Philadelphia.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So you learn more about people.
You know everything, and you know about their whole background, about their families, about whether their mother has colitis. I mean, you know everything that there is to know, and particularly if you're a kind of a storyteller, those details are absolutely important to you. And if you live if you move around, if you live in different places, you don't know those things. One of my students this summer, Elizabeth Spencer, came and gave a reading, and she read a wonderful story named Cousins. And then after the reading, one of my students burst into tears. And I said, well, what is the matter with you? Because it wasn't said, you know. And she said, well, I don't know my cousins. And she said, I don't have any place to write about. And I said, well, what do you remember from growing up? And she said, the mall. We used to go to the mall. And eventually that student wrote a wonderful piece about the mall, but still there's only so much you can say. I mean, those of us who had a very particular place and set of relatives and people to know really well are very enormously privileged today. Lots of people don't have that.
Of course, you lose a lot of your privacy.
You lose your privacy, and there's a way in which when you are growing up, you can't wait to leave. But then... once you realize that you don't have to be there forever, once you get that necessary distance from it, then it's wonderful to write about, I think.
Well, Alan Gerganis was telling me that there are some problems in addition to the lack of privacy. For example, when there's a death in the family, everybody brings over a covered dish, casserole.
Right.
And puts their name on it, of course, because they expect the casserole dish to be returned with a casserole inside.
That's right.
That's a lot of work.
I mean, it's a lot of work. You have to keep up. It's real hard. When I was growing up, we all had to go see my grandmother once a day. That was a lot of work. Everybody in the whole family had to go over there and show up. And so it's just a whole different set of conventions. And it does boil down to a lack of privacy and a lot of duty. And a lot of guilt if you don't do your duty. So,
weren't you Miss Grundy High School?
Yeah, I was. I did all that kind of small town growing up stuff.
What were your obligations as Miss Grundy High School?
Well, I had a set of Samsonite luggage, which I won. And my obligations were to smile an awful lot and be sweet, which I was never so good at. It was hard.
Did you have to ride a float?
Had to ride a float, that's right. Had to ride a float. Had to practice a wave, which is like this. The kind of the beauty queen wave.
And smile, of course.
And smile all the damn time, that's right.
Did you, when you were in high school, did you ever envision yourself being a writer? Were you doing some writing back then?
I tell you what, if I could make a living right now being a reader, I would just be a reader. I would never be a writer. I was always just an enormous reader, a closet reader. I mean, somebody that would go to bed and read with the flashlight under the covers all night long. And I just, that was my love. I mean, that was always my love. And I think the writing is really secondary to the reading. And I couldn't say why I started that either. It's just that I was an only child. And I think a lot of only children turn into readers. When I think of my kids, they always had each other to talk to and to play with and stuff. And so consequently, neither of them is a real reader of the kind I was.
Still, you must have been very popular, I mean, Miss Grundy High School.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I was a real reader, though, I think. And I was trying to write, but, you know, you don't know how to, when you're a kid, until you read stuff that's really good. I mean, until you know what's good, you don't know what to write about.
That's right. The old saying, you can't judge a book by its cover. And from a distance, all books look alike.
That's right. And I was absolutely indiscriminate.
Right.
Oh, yeah. I read the Reader's Digest condensed books that came to our house because my mother was in this club. And I read everything. And I couldn't tell the difference, I suppose, until I got to college. And I was always writing, but I was writing really terrible things. I mean, from the time I was 17 or 18, I was writing, but it was all bad. And I still remember the first time I read Eudora Welty. It just knocked me out because it was a little town. It wasn't so different from experiences that I'd had. But, I mean, you got to read somebody that can show you what your material is. For a long time, I think you don't know. I didn't know what it would be, I guess.
Yeah, I grew up with the world's great books, the Reader's Digest condensed books. My father was a firm believer in those condensations. And I guess they were better than nothing, but they have a point of view, generally. They're generally uplifting. And they're heavily sanitized.
Absolutely.
For example, I was talking to the editor of the Reader's Digest condensed books a couple of years ago, and he was telling me about their philosophy. And they're also books for people who are afraid of bookstores. You know, a lot of people don't like to go into bookstores.
Right, right.
And he said they would never publish a book such as William Styron's Sophie's Choice, which has a kind of a suicide pact at the end. You know, it's too much of a downer.
Mm-hmm.
And sex, of course, always ends with the closing of the door.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to kind of guess. You know, novels today are very explicit, but you won't find those.
Absolutely.
You know, you won't find those in the Reader's Digest condensed books. But I didn't know any different, and there were some good books, and I'm glad at least I had some exposure.
Oh, me too. Absolutely. Absolutely.
But now I see some of our young desk assistants out there. They come in with Judy Krantz or, books of that nature, and I try to give them reading lists. I mean, as long as they're going to but they, like you and like myself, at that stage in their development, they don't know what's good and what is commercially popular.
That's right. Yeah.
But as long as you're making the effort to read, you might as well read something good.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, you went off to Hollins College, right?
That's right.
Studied English?
Yeah. And that was a wonderful place to be because it was a place at that time that Louis Rubin, who was, I guess, encouraged a lot of young writers, was my writing teacher. And a lot of us were, Annie Dillard was in my class. She married one of our teachers. And we were just, everybody I knew was writing. I mean, it was a wonderful place to be as a young writer because everybody was just very encouraging. It was like, I don't know, it was like falling into a womb or something. It was just great. So I was lucky there, too.
They have a fairly well-regarded writing program.
They do. They have a master's in writing, and it's still that kind of place. And I think that is the best possible environment for a young writer.
Did you do your first serious writing while you were in
college? I did. I wrote my first novel as a senior in college. And eventually, after many, many changes, it was published.
Tell me about that novel. What was it called?
It was called The Last Day the Dog Bushes Bloomed. Mm-hmm. And it was, I guess, a very typical first novel. You know, it was an initiation story. It was in this little, very imaginative girl gives up her world of the imagination finally for the real world. I was real lucky. I don't think that novel would be published today as a first novel. I think it's much harder. This was published in 68, okay? So it's much, much harder today, I think, to publish a first novel that's really a quiet little novel like that. I was real lucky to do that. And I was real lucky to, I think, get a sense of myself as a writer then, you know, and then everything else, like having children and all. But I know so many women who sort of do other things, and then they say, okay, now I will be a writer. And I was real lucky. I didn't have to decide between having a family and being a writer or anything, because I just started writing early.
Mm-hmm.
And I think having that sense of yourself as a writer is real important to be able to keep doing it.
Must have been an exhilarating feeling being a senior in college and having a novel published.
Well, it wasn't published while I was in college. I was just writing it then. Mm-hmm. And again, everybody I knew was writing that much. I mean, it didn't seem like a big deal because there were just, I was in with a whole bunch of girls who were writing a lot. So it didn't seem unusual. And again, I think that's very, very important. Have a sense of this as something you can do, and it's not hard and it's not weird. It's okay.
Well, it's said that more books are being published today than ever before, and more books are being read, but we seem to have fewer and fewer publishers. I mean, I was talking to Richard Curtis, who is a literary agent, and he focuses primarily on genre books. But he was saying in the 1960s, when he entered the field, he probably had between 50 and 75 publishers of hardcover books,
mm-hmm,
that he could peddle fiction to. And there might be 15 to 25 now. There have been so many consolidations and mergers.
And it's a big, and the business aspect of it is really quite different. And I don't know what the statistics are, but I know that of books being published, and you might know, they're publishing lots less serious fiction, right? I mean, lots less. A lot of these books are not really books. I mean, they're sort of made up books. You know what I mean? I mean, they're personality books, they're how-to books, they're nonfiction books, they're all kinds of... They're not... I mean, the market for serious fiction is real hard, is real tough, I think, right now, because it does seem to me there's less of it being published.
Well, certainly you're going to have competition. Here's a slim book of wonderfully crafted short stories, and then you're going to have a Stephen King with a novel, and they're going to publish... 500,000 copies.
That's
of
right.
The first printing of a
Stephen
That's
King
right.
Yeah.
book. And the bookstores want to stack up these books to bring them in and to the malls.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that serious writers, and particularly young writers, now you're an established writer, what about young writers who want to sell their first fiction? It's going to be harder and harder for them, isn't it?
Well, see, I think this is tragic because I'm a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot tell you how many times I have read at least 6 or 7 first novels, okay, by kids, by young writers, that are really good novels, that are better, certainly than my first novel, certainly than many, many things that get published, which will never see print, just simply because it's so hard now. And it's so hard, it's what the publishing industry thinks its readers want, you know, and I think they do us readers a disservice. I think we can handle a lot more meat and potatoes than they're giving us. But I do see, I read a lot of very good fiction that is simply never published because it is so hard right now.
Well, I see an awful lot of junky books coming in. I'm not certain.
Me too!
Not necessarily fiction, but I mean books that I just wonder why somebody would even spend an effort. I mean, it could be the wonders of outboard motors.
Exactly. That's right. Why make it a book? I know. That's really true. And I think a lot of these are created by publishers. They say, hey, why don't you write a book about, you know, fitness walking or whatever it happens to be? And then they do it. And, you know, I don't know. I think the notion of books has changed. It really has.
Does the world really need another exercise book?
I don't know. Does the world really need another novel? I don't know that either. But it's hard for young writers.
The world always needs another novel.
Right now.
Needs another novel because people continually are finding new ways to express themselves and their own feelings and emotions. And only through the novel and through fiction do we really know how people think, really think. You know,
well, that's what we hope, those of us that do it.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it seems like a real crazy undertaking, though.
I was reading a biography of Aaron Copland, an autobiography of Aaron Copland, based on oral history. And it was quite interesting, but it wasn't really revealing. Copland spent page after page describing the people he knew, the places he went, the music he wrote, the orchestras he conducted. And at the end of the book, I began to feel that I didn't really know very much about him. For example, I didn't know anything about his homosexuality. There was a young man who kept popping up in the book over many years named Victor Kraft, with whom Copland lived. And when he died, Copland gave him two sentences. It's going to take someone else to really get into the heart and soul of Aaron Copland so we really know how he feels. And a novelist has a way, a knack of doing that, even if it's fiction.
Right. I think fiction is often more realistic in a funny way because there's that access, I don't know, into the heart, you know, that you can't say if it's nonfiction that you know this. You can't put it in, but you can imagine it probably in a funny way more realistically.
Now, your stories, these are wonderful stories, nine of them in this new
book.
Thank you. But there seems to be a recurring, I don't know if I want to call it a theme, but in almost every instance, there seems to be a failed marriage. This is obviously by design.
It's not by design.
Failed
but
marriage.
You know, but when you write a book of stories, you know, you write them over a certain period of time, and these have all been written over the last 6 or 7 years, and it just seemed to be a time when I was getting divorced, and so was everybody else I knew, and so that's what's happening to a lot of people when they're in their 30s, right? In the South, I think in some ways it's even harder because we're used to the notion of family is so big, you know, is so major, the notion of staying in one place, having one family, and so on. So I don't know. This has hit a lot of people that I know really hard. And I guess because I was writing that during, you know, the last 10 years, I guess, when this was happening to so many people I know, that is a recurring thing. But I didn't do it. I mean, I didn't do it on purpose.
There's also the issue of betrayal in the title story, Betrayal. But I guess this is fairly common everywhere, isn't it?
I think it is. I think it's, just because the South is the South doesn't mean that it's removed from the culture in which the issue of change and betrayal and lack of permanency and so on are big factors that we all have to deal with.
One story I really loved... Tongues of Fire. I really loved it.
That was the last one I wrote. That's the most recent one.
Well, the description of the summer camp was priceless. Did you go to a camp like that?
Exactly like that. In fact, the name of the camp is the real name of the camp. So, I mean, that story is, the events are made up, but in terms of the kind of child in that story, it's fairly autobiographical, I would say, which was the kind of child that is dying to be seized by God or dying to be a saint or anything that would be sort of exciting, I think. And those of us who grew up in small towns, lots of us sought that through revivals or through whatever. And
those impulses thankfully go away, though, don't they?
They do. Thank God we grow up somehow.
Well, the... No, of course, you're well known for your novels, but here as a collection, I guess it's your second collection.
Yeah,
of stories,
I love stories. I love stories much, much more than novels.
Why?
I don't know. You can't completely
develop the characters in the way you can in a novel.
You can't. And just about all you can do is crack the door and peer in, really, with a story. And with a novel, of course, you can, you know, open the door and walk in and close the door behind you and stay for a while. But there's something about stories that I just love. It's maybe because I grew up hearing stories, you know, from people in my family and so on. But it just, I don't know, it's a form that I love. And I think now there is a kind of a resurgence of interest in the short story, it seems to me. And that I've been reading a lot of awfully good stories lately, and I'm glad to see it.
I think your impression may be right. I'm getting a lot of review copies of short stories.
Good.
More than I had in the past, I think.
Yeah.
But there's another difference between a short story and a novel, in that you can afford to make some mistakes with a novel in terms of
exactly.
writing, carelessness,
yeah.
or overdevelopment or lack of it. But a short story, it seems to me, has to be as near perfect as you can make it.
Good,
you know what I'm saying?
Which you can never get.
No, you can never get it. But it's the flaws in a short story are more
right.
obvious than in a novel.
Yeah.
Because the flaws can be buried in a novel sometimes.
I think you're right. I think in terms of writing, for me, I have always felt that a novel is the easiest form because you can make a lot of mistakes and still maybe have the novel approximate what you hope. With a short story, it has to be mostly right. With a poem, every word has to be right, which is why I would, you know, shoot myself in the head if I was trying to write a poem, because that's really scary. You know, the more reductive it is, the scarier it gets.
Well, I was shortly before his death, I was talking to Raymond Carver.
And, were you?
I'd interviewed him a number of times, and each time he had told me that he had been under enormous pressure from publishers and editors and friends to write a novel. And he had tried. But he just couldn't get the momentum going to do it.
His stories are so perfect, though.
Yeah.
I wonder if you can write stories that perfectly, I can't imagine that you would even want to write a novel.
Well, he said in the last interview I had with him, he said, you know, I've tried to write a novel. I haven't been able to do it. And he said, you know something? It's all right if I don't.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. In some ways, I felt like the novel maybe a form of middle age, kind of, I don't know quite. It's like to me, like writing a story, you have to feel the sort of same intensity, you know, like a lyric poem or something. I mean, it's just wham, it's just like I don't know what it's like. It's a real rush, okay, to write a short story. But the older I get, I find that the more interested I am in the long haul. I mean, the more interested I am in knowing what happened next and then how that affected the kids and this kind of thing. So I think I'm just now maybe beginning to get a sense of a novel. But mm-hmm. You never with a novel experience the intensity that you do when you're writing a story.
Well, a lot of novels have sprung from short stories. I was, last week I interviewed Bud Schulberg on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of What Makes Sammy Run.
Oh, yes.
And that started as a short story. Two short stories, actually,
mm-hmm.
were published, I believe, I can't remember, but the magazine now. But back in the 1940s, published these two short stories. He was a student at Dartmouth at the time. And he, Bennett Cerf, read one of the stories and liked it and called him and said, maybe you could develop this into a novel. And he did.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
the rest is history.
Something that I have thought more recently, I did that with the first several novels that I wrote, which is to have a short story and extend it. But I'm not so sure. I mean, in a way, I think the last couple of novels I wrote, I thought of as novels,
mm-hmm.
which to me seemed to make a lot more sense, finally. I just had never been able to do that. I always thought of them as long, short stories, but they're not, I think. I don't know. So I'm being real inarticulate now.
No, you're not.
you can cut me.
how do you develop an idea for a short story? The reason I ask is that Bobby Ann Mason is...
I love her short stories. I love Life.
And she's unusual, though. Sometimes she'll just start with a sentence and then develop it. And it would seem to me that when you sit down to write a short story, have the story pretty well in your mind.
I do.
And she says she doesn't have anything in her mind except maybe a theme. Like, for example, one of the short stories in Love Life was generated after she saw some bees in an attic. I don't remember that story. I can't remember.
That specifically.
But anyway,
yeah,
she had the vision of these bees that she saw
yeah.
in childhood buzzing and out of the attic, and that was the basis for the story, and she began writing it based on that. And that's all she knew at the time.
That's
pretty risky, though, isn't it?
I would think it would be risky. I don't know. What I have is I think my real interest is in the people. And what I do is I'll have a lot of people that I'll get in mind, the characters, and at any given time, I have about 20 people sort of walking around in my mind that I know I want to write a story about. But, and I have no trouble imagining the people and imagining how they would spend sort of every minute of their day and imagining their houses and all this kind of stuff. What I have trouble with is thinking of a plot. I mean, thinking of a story. So at some point, these people will sort of, I'll read something in the newspaper, say, and I'll have these characters that'll say, hey, that's my story, and we'll sort of leap out, and then I can write it. But I always start with the people, and it's just real hard for me to imagine what they'll do, you know, but imagine them is not so hard.
Well, what do you do with a short story once you've finished writing it?
What do I do with
it? Yeah, I mean, where do people read short stories today?
Well, again, that's a real problem because the market for short stories, I think, is really, really tough. And I think that's why a lot of people try to write novels, because it's a kind of a sad... I think you read them in literary magazines is where you read the best short stories. I think you read good stories in Harper's and Atlantic and Esquire, but there are very few major magazines that publish short stories.
Yeah,
and of those, there are so few that will just take them without an agent. So for the young writer, I think it's the literary magazines is where you find the good fiction.
Yeah, but these literary magazines, they come out as...
They pay you $30.
Yeah, they're not even speaking about the money,
yeah.
But they come out on a quarterly basis, and they may only have 3 stories in an issue.
That's right.
And so you're talking maybe 8-10 stories a year,
mm-hmm,
in one magazine. I mean, that's not very much.
I think those of us who write short stories probably finally do it because we just love it and we can't help doing it. I think it's just something that, you know, I got in trouble once for telling a group at a writer's conference that if they could possibly stop, they should. You know, because, I mean, it is. You're not going to make money. It is going to be disappointing. But it's just there's something about writing a story and getting it the way you want it that is totally satisfying. I mean, it's just a totally satisfying thing to do. And that's the reason to do it, I think, not because you will, because it is hard to find a place to publish them and hard to find readers.
Also, do you warn your students about the rejection? Bobby Ann Mason was saying that her stuff has been rejected and rejected and rejected, but she has patience and a supply of envelopes and stamps and keeps sending them out.
That's right. That's what you've got to do. But, you know, it's so hard to convince the young writer or to try to show them how to think of themselves as separate from the story. Think of the rejection as the rejection of some words that happen to be typed on some paper. You know, and not them. I mean, that they are not being rejected and their relationships are not being rejected and their relationship with their mother is not being rejected or whatever it is, that it's just some stuff that they typed on some paper. I mean, it's real hard, particularly for the young writer, to disassociate herself or himself from the story, and you've got to do it, finally. You got to do it.
Well, writing is a good thing to do, even if, maybe you've told your students this, even if they don't go into writing as a professional writer, studying writing seems to me would give a student all sorts of insights into people. And
oh, it does.
A way to use words that the ordinary person doesn't.
I think it does, and I think forever after they read differently. And a lot of them have told me that. I mean, I think it just helps you read in a whole different way. But also, I think one of the main things that happens is, you know, whatever you're writing about yourself in a way. And it usually, to be in a writing class where you have to write, makes you think about things differently. It makes you have a greater degree of awareness of yourself. It's like... It's a wonderful thing that Peter Taylor once said, I don't know what I think till I read what I've written. And I think it's great. I mean, it's a tool of self-expression and self-understanding. And in that sense, publishing is kind of the least of it.
Well, Lee Smith, we're almost out of time. I did want to ask you, your last novel, Fair and Tender Lady?
Yes.
That had kind of an interesting origin. You found a cache of letters, I understand.
Yeah, I found that. Well, I love to go to flea markets and yard sales and poke around, and I went to one, and there were these two mean sisters who were selling off everything that had been in their mother's house after she died. And one of the things they were selling was this big box of her letters, all the letters that she had received in her lifetime. And I said, well, did y'all read these letters? And they said, no, we don't want to read those letters. And I said, how much will you sell them to me for? And they said, $1. And I said, 75 cents. No, and I did. But I bought them, and I took them home and read them. And it's just amazing the sense of her whole life and her sister's lives and so on. And it just gave me the idea of writing a novel that would happen in letters.
Epistolary, I think it's called.
It's an epistolary novel, yeah. But it's for that same reason that you just said, because it's like in letters, I think we use them as a way to communicate, but also a way to document our lives, you know, to say, to figure out what's important to us is what we write in the letter. And just that notion of writing not as a public thing, I think, is writing in the way that Simone de Beauvoir said, is to lead an examined life, you know, as a means of leading an examined life. And so that's what the protagonist of that novel is supposed to be doing in her letter writing. And I think that's what a lot of us write for.
Are we going to see it in paperback soon?
It's in paperback.
Oh, is it on
paperback?
It is,
yeah.
When did it come out in paperback?
Not so long ago, just very recently from Ballantyne.
Oh, good.
Looks good.
Good. I'm going to I'll mention the fact that it's available in paperback now.
Great.
That's great. Well, it's nice talking to you again, Lee. Are you staying with Roy Blunt, by the way?
Not this time. No, not this time, but we just saw him.
So. He's funny.
He's wonderful.
Yeah. Last time I saw him, we did a video together. It was a pilot for a video version of this broadcast, which they were never able to sell it, but he was so helpful.
He's wonderful, and he is so at ease. You know, I mean, I've known him for about 20 years, and he just sort of gets easier, you know, and funnier. It's amazing.
I think he was also helpful to you in the beginning.
He was, absolutely. Yeah, well, I was...
kind of a mentor.
Yes, he was definitely a mentor. I was really stymied at a certain point, and I didn't have an agent, I didn't have an editor, I'd written three books, and they'd all sort of disappeared, and he kind of stepped in and found me an agent and sort of took me under his wing for a little while. It was very helpful.
Well, you're going to have to buy him dinner then.
Barbecue.
Barbecue.
That's right.
These are wonderful stories. Me and My Baby, A View of the Eclipse. Lee Smith, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.